There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. But how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day in a way that honors Him? I mean, it's one thing, you know, to give people a piece of our mind, which they don't really need, but they very much do need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I think you are just the person to give it to them. I've posted some resources for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Hopefully, you can find things there that are going to actually help you do what we're talking about, which is to be an effective ambassador of Jesus Christ, an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. So connect with us there online, reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, Reuters posted a story yesterday that at least among the folks who are on Twitter and the folks who are interested in such things at the intersection of religion and politics and things that are happening in America, that, you know, folks are motivated out of religious conviction. And sometimes we think about only people of conservative religious faith or conservative religious expression, that these are really the only people who are motivated on the forefront of the political conversation. Well, that's not so true anymore. So this article from Reuters says the religious left is emerging as a United States political force in the Trump era. So this article is by Scott Malone. Here's the lead. Since President Donald Trump's election, monthly lectures on social justice at the 600-seat Gothic Chapel in New York's Union Theological Seminary have been filled to capacity with crowds three times what they usually draw. So apparently back in January, they had to turn away about 1,000 people, which means about 1,600 showed up. So, you know, they filled the chapel at New York's Union Theological Seminary, one of the most liberal seminaries in the country. They had turned away 1,000 people from a lecture on mass incarceration, which, let me just pause there for a moment. There's no such thing as mass incarceration. People are incarcerated one person at a time. So anyway, language matters, and we don't actually incarcerate whole groups of people. We incarcerate individuals. It has resulted in a criminal justice system that seems very inequitable, and that is worthy of our conversation talking about, but let's use words that actually are meaningful. All right, so in her 9 years of being there, the president of Union Theological Seminary in New York, not to be confused with Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, the president of Union New York is the Reverend Serene Jones, and she said she's never seen such crowds. Here's basically what progressives are saying. They're basically saying that the election of Donald Trump has been a clarion call to progressive Christians, progressive Protestants, and progressive Catholics to move out of a place of primarily confessing progressive policies to really taking action. So there's no question that both progressive Protestants, that would be mainline Christians for the most part, and progressive Catholics, which I know some of you are saying, what in the world is a progressive Catholic? But they do exist. And we talk about folks whose primary leading edge of political concern is evidenced in what we might call social justice issues. Now, here's what's unfair about that. I know a lot of evangelical Christians who are theologically conservative who have a high level of concern for social justice. And so I don't think these categories are as neat and tidy as folks might want them to be. I don't think that evangelicals want to necessarily be seen as a voting bloc. I think they want to be understood as people who have been changed by the power of the gospel, and they are then motivated by that redemptive worldview to seek to seek justice in the culture at large. Likewise, progressive Christians are operating out of a progressive view of human history, and they believe that progress is toward a more utopian future for everyone here on Earth. And so the religious right and the religious left actually probably have some very similar ways of going about things, and yet it'd be pretty hard to define today who really belongs in the spectrum of the mushy middle. And I think that's really important in this conversation as we recognize, or some people are pointing to, you know, the death of the religious right, other people pointing to the rise of the religious left. Really, I think what we're talking about here is, I'm hoping, the growing influence of folks actually in the middle. But here's how the article says, you know, we've recognized the religious right for a long time, and we've credited the religious right with helping to elect presidents and other kinds of lifting up other kinds of characters in the culture. The article goes on to say that, but the religious left is now slowly coming of age. And they talk about this being a group that is very diverse, propelled into political activism by Trump's policies on immigration, healthcare, and social welfare. Quote, it's one of the dirty little secrets of American politics that there has long been a religious left, says Patrick Hornbeck II, chairman of the theology department at Fordham University, which is a Jesuit school in New York. He says, but it has taken a crisis, a perceived crisis, like Donald Trump's election, to cause folks on the religious left to really own their religion in the square. So that's pay attention to. This isn't just about the practice of faith somehow, or this isn't even just about the pursuit of social justice. This is about organized political activism that is based in some kind of faith, some kind of expression of the faith. So here are two paragraphs that I really want to lift up and discuss. So although support for the religious left is difficult to measure, says Malone, who writes this article, leaders point to several examples, such as the surge of congregations offering to provide sanctuary to immigrants seeking asylum. Now, let's just stop right there. That is people who are in the country illegally or have overstayed a visa and therefore are here illegally now. That is a different issue than the refugee issue, which is the answer to the question given in the following paragraph, which says the number of churches volunteering to offer sanctuary to asylum seekers. Now, asylum seekers is one very specific category of refugees. Okay, so this is I just want to say there is a conflation of issues in these two paragraphs that do not belong together in the same space. So, but the paragraph's important because it does say that the number of churches volunteering to offer sanctuary to asylum seekers doubled to 800. After the election. Now, that is according to the Indiana-based Church World Service, which is a coalition of Christian denominations, which helps what? Helps refugees settle in the United States. This has nothing to do with illegal immigrants. Okay? Churches that are offering asylum to refugees is a whole different situation than churches offering sanctuary status to people who are in the country illegally. So I just want you, when you read these articles, I want you to pay attention. I want you to pay attention to the words. I want you to pay attention to the players. And I want you to pay attention to the conflation of ideas. Because I got to tell you, there's a lot of evangelical churches that whose arms are open wide and whose doors are open wide to the resettlement of refugees in the United States, particularly those who are religious minorities under persecution in other parts of the world. So I think that that particular issue is not necessarily a helpful one to raise here. However, the issue of universal health care, ensuring, quote, that no people lose their health insurance as a result of what's going on in Congress, that particular issue, that's pretty much progressives stomping around mad about that. So there are LGBTQ issues lifted up in here. They describe them as vulnerable populations who need protection. And they describe the refugee community as a part then of this list, and then the undocumented community. So I lift this article up to you so that you will know what's happening in terms of a political wave. I don't think anyone is surprised by the fact that there is a lot of energy out there across the country right now. Some some wave of energy in support of the president, but certainly a wave of energy in opposition to the president. If you've been paying attention to his polling numbers, they are officially deplorable. He's down at like 37% approval rating. That's pretty bad. So there are a lot of folks across the country who are anti-Trump. And if that motivation is actually compelled by religion, you and I both know that's a very powerful influence in a person's life. So just because you may say to yourself, yes, but they're theologically wrong in their progressive understanding of history versus a redemptive understanding of history, you know what? I got to tell you, the political environment doesn't really parse the theological pie that thin. So if a person is motivated out of their religion, out of their religious faith, you and I both know that fervor can be pretty great. Now, and as I was looking at that article from Reuters, this article from the New York Times, the op-ed page popped up, and it says, to win again, Democrats must stop being the abortion party. Now, here's where the progressive left is going to stumble over itself, okay? Because we have the religious left now, and I got to tell you, the religious left is pretty pro-abortion. The religious left has moved mainline Christian denominations into a pro-abortion stance. And I know you're saying to yourself, how could a church ever take a pro-abortion stance? Well, many of them have. The Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the UCC, they're all pro-abortion denominations. They all provide abortions for any reason under their own health care plans. They promote abortion. They absolutely are on the side of Planned Parenthood. And so if you don't think this is going on, it is. There is a religious fervor on behalf of really on behalf of the Democratic Party's plank, which is also very pro-abortion. Okay, well, this particular op-ed by Thomas Groom, and I should tell you that Thomas Groom is a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College, and so he's an immigrant. I think that's important to recognize. He came to this country from Ireland 45 years ago, and when he arrived, his cousin said, hey, if you're a Catholic, which you are, you vote Democrat when you're here. And so he'd grown up in the Irish Republic. He says, I was well disposed to Republican Party principles like local autonomy and limited government, but my commitment to social justice, so central to my own faith, seemed better represented at the time by the Democrat Party. Okay, Democratic Party 45 years ago, that's what he's talking about. And so he became a Democrat. However, over the course of time, the Democrats' erosion on the issue, particularly of the protection of life, and the fact that Democrats now, in Groom's words, unconditionally support abortion, means that he and other Catholics like him fled this year from Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump. And essentially, the shift in the Catholic vote, in just among white Catholics, there's a 23-point loss by Clinton to Trump among white Catholics in America. And so he's making the argument that the way for the Democratic Party to win back the Catholics, to win back the Roman Catholics, is for the Democrats to, you know, cut off this pro-abortion plank from their, you know, from their platform. He says, for many traditional Catholic voters, Mrs. Clinton's unqualified support for abortion rights was the tipping point. He said that abortion continues to trigger the deepest moral concern for many traditional Catholics, including me. You may remember the conversation that we had about this with Michael Ware. Michael Ware served in the Faith Outreach Office of President Obama, and he talked about the failure of the Democratic Party in this election cycle to pay any attention whatsoever. He says they basically wrote off the Catholic vote. Well, you're right off of the Catholics on this issue because you wanted abortion more than you wanted Catholics. That's essentially what the Democratic Party decided in this last cycle. And Michael Ware, shared with us, and I mean, he viewed that as a real mistake, and that there's real work to be done to regain the Catholic vote for the Democratic Party. Well, here are Thomas Groom's recommendations to the Democratic Party of how they could re-win the Catholic vote. Number one, the Democrat politicians should publicly acknowledge that abortion is an issue of profound moral and religious concern. Now, those are not the categories that Democrats use to talk about abortion. They don't talk about moral and religious concern. They talk about the autonomy of the woman and her right to her body and her right to choose. They don't talk about moral and religious concern. He goes on to say, Democrats should not threaten to repeal the Hyde Amendment, which forbids federal funds to be used for abortion except in extreme circumstances. Well, I got to tell you, if you think that that abortion is a good thing, then you want to see taxpayer dollars used for it. And so the repeal of the Hyde Amendment would remain, in my view, on the Democratic platform. And finally, he says, Democratic politicians should also continue to frame their efforts to improve health and social services as a way to decrease abortions. Again, that's suggesting that abortion is bad. And I don't think that on the question of morality, it's my opinion that Democrats are not going to elevate the moral concern, particularly the moral concern related to the protection of life, over what they view as the primary concern of the woman, which is her autonomy. Again, this comes down to a conversation of worldviews. And I lift up these articles so that you can actively engage in these conversations with others in your spheres of influence. These are conversations that are being had. You may have a friend who is more progressive theologically than you are, okay? Comes at things from a more liberal viewpoint in terms of their theology. Well, this is a good opportunity for, this is a good season in which to talk with them about the full expression of religious conscience in the public square. You know, suddenly, if those on the political left suddenly more interested in hearing from religiously motivated voters, because some of those religiously motivated voters happen to be progressives, then this might be a great opportunity for us to actually elevate conversations about religious liberty and religious expression in the public square, which and the protection of religious conscience, which have been things, by the way, that have been labeled, castigated as discriminatory by folks on the left against folks on the right, as if those who come to the public square motivated by religious conviction are all bigots. And so I'm just telling you, this is actually an opportunity, and we should enter into conversations with folks who, although they come from, they come to the conversation with a different perspective in terms of the faith, they are coming to the conversation out of a religious motivation. And I think we should be able to capitalize on that. All right, now here's something interesting for you. This article is entitled, Atheists and Highly Religious People Are the Least Scared of Death. This is by Mike McRae. And this is I just got to tell you, this, you got to go to sciencealert.com to find this, which I know is probably not something that you are out there reading every day, but this is a really fascinating, it's a study of studies. So they aggregated a bunch of studies that have taken place, and they're looking to cull out information related to the relationship between fear and death, well, or the fear of death, and whether or not your religious convictions or your non-religious convictions matter at all. So maybe not surprisingly, they found that people who are highly religious are less afraid of death than people who are nominally religious or kind of non-religious. But then the committed atheists are also not afraid of death, according to this survey of this study of studies. So here's the hypothesis. The conflict between our desire to live and our knowledge of the inevitability of death is a key driver behind many cultural values and rituals. So what they're trying to seek the answer to is, do we do what we do in life because of our perception of what happens when we die? Well, I will say that, you know, as a person who not only believes in the reality of a personal beginning, that God is the one who created us in his image on purpose and for a purpose, but that it is to that personal God that my life is ultimately going to be returned, that I'm going to spend all of eternity in the full presence of God, who not only knows me fully, but at that point I will have the opportunity to fully know. I mean, that is really an amazing promise, and it's a promise that's already fulfilled in Jesus Christ. So I live every day with that knowledge, with the full confidence of that, with no question in my mind. Now, that's not to say that, you know, I, like everyone else, don't have passing doubts from time to time. I mean, I don't want to say that I'm some, you know, like super spiritual, person. But I have an intimate connection with God that's restored in Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit animates my life. Like, I'm already dead. I've already died the most important death I'm going to die, and that's the death to sin and the reality of its power in my life now and its penalty in my life to come. That's it. It's over. That spell is broken, right? So do I want to die? No. Do I fear it? No. Do I know where I'm going when I die? Yes, absolutely, in full confidence. And if I actually love people, then my motivation and purpose in this life is to invite other people into that reality. Like, how much would I have to hate someone not to share the good news with them? So, what the study of studies reveals is that there's these two groups of people who actually make decisions in the context of life. Cultural value decisions, ritual decisions, actually what we do, how we spend our time, how we spend our money, what we do for leisure, our political affiliations, our social groups, all of that is influenced by whether or not you fear death to the point that it changes the way you live, or that you do not fear death to the point that it changes the way you live. Either one of those things holds true according to this study. So there's two groups of people who don't fear death. The first group is probably this crowd like me who, like, you know, believes profoundly in the reality of the personal nature of the universe, recognizes the reality of who God is, that it is from God that I have come and to God that I am returning, all by God's grace and not by anything that I've done. So there's that crowd. And then there is the totally atheist crowd. These aren't your nominal non-believers. These aren't your nuns. These are the hardcore atheists, man. These are the people who have no fear of death because they have no belief in anything after death. So why would you fear nothingness? I mean, it's not even the fear of nothingness. It's they don't think there's anything there. There's no there there. There's no good there there. There's no bad there there. There's just no there there. Okay? So this is all that there is. And so what I wrote down here was I just think that those are folks for whom maybe the book of Ecclesiastes is the one to which we send them in terms of a conversation. But I really wanted to point out from all of this that the vast majority of people, the overwhelming majority of people, live between those two poles. The overwhelming majority of people that you meet on any given day live somewhere between those two poles, which means they fear death. And they are actually doing what they're doing today. They're doing what they're doing in life because out of some motivation of the fear of death. Now, I want you to consider that for a moment. And I want you to consider how that should change your conversations with those people. How do you engage with a person who gets a bad medical diagnosis if you know they really fear death? How do you comfort a person at the loss of a child if they really don't trust that there's a God there and that there's a there in terms of heaven? How do you walk with a person through the difficulties of life if their ultimate fear is death? Because death's coming for us all. It is the inevitable. I mean, it's more inevitable than taxes. Taxes are coming, but you can put those off to October if you have to, right? If your name is written down in the Lamb's Book of Life on a certain day, I got to tell you, your days are numbered. And when the number is up, it's up. And there's really not a whole lot you can do about that. And so I think that these conversations are conversations that are important for us to have with the kids in the back seat and the person in the seat next to us in the car and the person that we're sitting down for coffee or lunch with. You could just say, you know, I'm in this group. I'm in this not fear death group because I know where I'm going. I know my Savior. I know who he is. Where are you at on these issues? That's the question we got to ask people. Are you in the fear death group? Are you in the no fear of death group? I'm in the no fear of death group because I know my Savior and I know he lives. All right, friends. Hey, when we come back, we're going to be talking. We're going to have a really great conversation. We got a Jewish believer in Jesus who's going to talk with us not only about Messianic Judaism, but going to talk with us about anti-Semitism. Stay with me through the break. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. Indeed, our help comes from Jesus Christ, who shoulders the burden, not only of the penalty of our sin and death, but the power of sin in life today. Hey, we're trying to put God back in his place, right where he belongs, in the middle of every conversation, and we invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. We're not just talking about what people are talking about in the culture today. We're also talking with people who can help us understand the news of the day and further equip us to be more effective ambassadors of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And so I'm happy to introduce you today to Jonathan Burness. He is a Jewish believer in Jesus who has been a leader in Messianic Jewish ministry for more than 30 years. He currently serves as president and CEO of Jewish Voice Ministries International, which you can find on Twitter at Jewish_voice. And you can also find that at jewishvoice.org. Rabbi Burness is the founder of Congregation Shema Israel in Rochester, New York, where he served as senior Messianic rabbi from 1984 to 1993, as well as the Messianic Center of St. Petersburg, Russia, where he lived and ministered from 1993 to 1996. He hosts a syndicated television program, Jewish Voice with Jonathan Burness, broadcast to over, get this number, people, 717 million homes worldwide through local cable and satellite networks, as well as the internet. So we welcome you today to The Reconnect.
Carmen, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's absolutely a pleasure to talk with you. So there are a couple of headline news stories that I want to discuss with you. But before we get to those, can we just lay some groundwork? Help us understand what anti-Semitism is and what it is not.
Okay, anti-Semitism, although some would challenge this and define it more widely, because the word Semitic incorporates not only Jewish people, but people of Mideast origin that would include the Arab world. But anti-Semitism, really since World War II and the Holocaust, has been more narrowly defined as a hatred or animosity against the Jewish people, the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And most books on anti-Semitism, Carmen, will tell you that it's completely illogical, that it is there, that there's no sensible understanding of why anti-Semitism exists. I believe that it is very logical, that it is systematic, when you understand that there is a devil, a literal Satan, that seeks to destroy God's plan, discredit God, rob, steal, and destroy. And I believe that the author of anti-Semitism is Satan himself, who wants to derail the plan of God, which includes the restoration and the preservation and restoration of the Jewish people.
Okay, so there's a couple of headline news stories that are related to this subject, and that's why I wanted us to have some, you know, lay some groundwork of what, from a Jewish perspective, from a Messianic Jewish perspective, what does this word mean? Because out of the United Nations, we've got this conversation, this ongoing conversation, where they write these reports and they make these statements and they issue these decrees that seem to many people, they're not only anti-Israel, sometimes that is conflated with anti-Semitic. Can you help us understand sort of the groundwork, what's happening on the ground, both at the UN and in Israel? Kind of just give us some context for even understanding that conversation.
Sure. So I need to introduce another term, anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism, and there's been a lot of work over the decades to separate anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism is the an effort to stop the growth of a movement of Jewish people that began in at the turn of the 20th century, around 1897, 1898, a return of the Jewish people back to the land of their forefathers. Of course, the land that is today known as Israel, but was known back at that time as Palestine. It was changed originally by the Romans and then kept by the British, who occupied what's now known as Israel today, after World War I up until 1948. And that Zionism, the return of the Jewish people, the idea of Jewish people returning to their homeland, began to grow through the 19th century and into the 20th century, and then culminated with the restoration of the State of Israel in 1948. Since that time, but in more recent times, since the Six-Day War and the restoration of Jerusalem in 1967, there's been a wholesale effort orchestrated by what are today called the Palestinians. They didn't identify as the Palestinians back then until post-1967, and by the Arab Islamic states to combat this effort of Jews or this movement of Jews to return to their homeland. In fact, Carmen, anti-Zionism, which you can certainly see in the UN, Israel's been cited more times than any other nation in the world, including Iran and North Korea, cited for human rights violations. But not only do you have anti-Zionism in the UN, you have anti-Semitism, which again is this hatred of the Jewish people and an effort to eradicate the Jewish people, or whatever, or really God's plan for the Jewish people. And in fact, the two are linked together. They're inseparably linked. It's a lie that they're completely autonomous and divided from each other. Anti-Zionism is a reflection of anti-Semitism, and the modern effort to wipe Israel off the face of the map is really an ongoing demonic effort that's continued, fueled by Islamic fundamentalism since the Nazis. So it's really a continuation of a Nazi agenda to destroy the Jewish people. It's that simple.
All right, folks, we are talking with Jonathan Burness. You can find out a whole lot about what he's talking about at jewishvoice.org. You can read one of many books, but he's got one entitled A Rabbi Looks at the Supernatural, which you might be interested in. And you can follow what he's doing on Twitter at Jewish_voice. Now, Rabbi Burness, you raised a number of words and issues and concerns in that great answer to what was a really poor question when I asked it. So thank you for sifting through it so adeptly. You raised the issue of the Nazis, which takes us back to an experience of the Jewish people, probably what all of us associate with anti-Semitism. We associate it with the Holocaust. You have some personal, in fact, every Jewish person who I know has some personal experience in terms of their own family and the events of the Holocaust. But in the conversation that we're having as a country today, in terms of not only immigration, but the vetting of refugees and all of those conversations, can you share with us from your own personal your perspective on what's happening today based on what happened then?
I would be happy to, and thanks for asking the question, Carmen. I think it's a very, very significant one. So every Jewish person in the world was affected by the Holocaust. American Jews lost family members. European Jews were two-thirds of the European Jewish community were wiped out. And the Jewish population of Poland went from 3 million to 300 as a result of the Holocaust. One of the great tragedies of the Holocaust, looking beyond the 6 million that were exterminated simply because they were Jews, was the refugees that fled from concentration camps or fled from Germany and other occupied European countries in order to find freedom and safety, and they were rejected by every single nation, including the United States. There's one incident, for example, a ship called the St. Louis that sought, there was over 1,000 refugees, Jews, that sought shelter. Canada refused the ship rights to dock the United States, Cuba, and on through South America. In the end, they ended up returning to Germany, and many of them died in concentration camps. There's a small group of survivors that still commemorate the St. Louis, and they've been honored by a number of Christian groups. But that's one example. So the fact that the nations of the world, including America, turned their backs on the Jewish people is a very sad fact of history. To compare what's happening today and President Trump's efforts to protect America to the Holocaust is absurd. If you look back at the Holocaust, these refugees did not have terrorists embedded in the numbers that were seeking refuge. And we're not talking about banning immigration. We're talking about developing controls to make America safe, to keep America to screen out a potential Islamic Shiite fundamentalist, Sunni fundamentalist that are dedicated to the destruction of Israel and America. That's a very, very different issue. And to draw a parallel between the two for a Jew, for a Jewish believer like me, is absolutely absurd. Carmen, let me just say I'm very sensitive as a Jew after the Holocaust to people that are seeking refuge, freedom, safety from Syria and other troubled nations, but not to have restrictions given the fact that we know from intelligence that they're embedded in these communities are Muslim radicals. We can't ignore that. So I really have an issue with the linkage of these two.
Okay, so I want to ask you about this Jewish young man who has now been arrested in Israel and accused of being the person, or at least among the people, who've made, you know, more than 100 bomb threats to Jewish targets here in the United States, Jewish community centers, and other targets. Can you explain to us, because it's a complicated thing for a non-Jewish person to understand how a Jewish person could seemingly, in this particular instance, seem to be anti-Semitic?
Yes, it's very complex, and Christians have to understand, Carmen, that the Jewish community is not monolithic. In other words, they don't all have the same views concerning Israel. There's a very large left-wing Jewish community in the United States that's very pro-Palestinian to the detriment of the state of Israel. It's very, very hard for me. I understand it as a Jew because we're so pluralistic, but it's very hard to explain to a Christian audience. You actually have a group in Israel of fundamentalist, Orthodox Jewish fundamentalists that are anti-Israel because they believe that only the Messiah can establish the restored land of Israel. But it's a very small fringe group, and there's Jewish people that are really on the fringe. Some of them hate their own identity, hate the state of Israel, but it doesn't represent a significant number of people. You have people that are emotionally disturbed, people that are fanatics and very confused, and it would take a long time to go into the details of the different theology and philosophy behind those that are actually anti-Israel and Jew haters as Jews. You're asking me a really hard question.
Well, that's okay. I appreciate that that you simply acknowledge that, first of all, it's really complex. It's not simple. And actually, Christians understand just how diverse Christians are when we try to talk about what it means to be Christian. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many people are in the room, there are more than that number of opinions about the answer to that question. And so I think that just saying to Christians, hey, Jews are not monolithic in the same way that Christians are not monolithic. Jews have denominations, and even in the midst of those denominations, wide disagreements. And Jews who live in the context of Israel and have made Aliyah have a very different perspective than Jews who are living diaspora around the world and don't have the kind of heart affection, for whatever reason, for the land that the people who have returned there do. So I do think
exactly.
that it's it's nuanced, it's complex, and I think just actually saying so is a good way to start. Hey, before I let you go,
Carmen, let me just throw this little joke in. We have a saying in the Jewish community: if you have two Jews, you have three opinions that come from the two Jews. It's a little humor, but it's very true.
Absolutely,
a lot of diversity.
Well, I have two more things that I want to talk with you about, and we don't have time to do both of them, so I'm hoping that we can have you back. I really want, at some point, for you to be able to just wax eloquent about why a thorough study of the Old Testament is actually essential to even understanding who Messiah is and certainly living as a messianic person today. But we're going to have to come back to that.
I want to,
before I let you go, I want you to tell folks what Jewish Voice is and what Jewish Voice Ministries International does.
Well, thank you for asking that. I'm not the founder of Jewish Voice. A man named Lewis Kaplan founded the ministry 3 months before the Six-Day War broke out in 1967 with a specific word from the Lord to reach his people. He was a Jewish believer who had been ejected from his house because of his faith. He had to leave and ride the rails back in the 1930s and 40s and was estranged from his parents. I took over the ministry in 1999 and have been leading it ever since. Jewish Voice is a ministry dedicated to reaching the world with the good news that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel and Savior for the world, but understanding and incorporating into that Romans 1:16, where Paul says that the gospel is the power of God for unto salvation to all who believe, to the Jew first. And so our ministry is dedicated to bringing the gospel to the Jew first in ways that earn the right to share with Jewish people. And we also go, Carmen, to unique communities of the world that are open to the gospel. So in the 1990s, it was working with the Jewish community in Russia, holding international festivals of Jewish music and dance, where we saw tens of thousands of Jewish people in stadiums and concert halls respond to altar calls, inviting them to receive Jesus, or we call him by his Hebrew name, Yeshua, as their Messiah and Savior. After the doors began to close in Russia, the Lord led us on to Africa, where we've been working among the Ethiopian Jews and also a group called the Lemba in Zimbabwe, and now we've begun to work among the Igbo tribe in Nigeria and helping to determine their Jewish heritage. We provide medical care, dental care, eye care in the form of short-term clinics, water purification, and most importantly, the gospel. So we're a unique ministry that is seeking out Jewish communities open to the gospel in the remotest places of the world, and it's a real adventure.
I just love it. It's it is an adventure, and you are just the right person to be doing it. And so thank you for what you do every day, but thank you for joining us today on the Reconnect. We're going to have lots more conversations with you because I want to delve with you into what it was like to be in Russia in the days of Boris Yeltsin. But we're going to have to come back to that as well.
Thank you, Carmen. Hey. I look forward to being back with you.
Thank you. Jonathan Burness, thank you so much. You guys can find him at jewishvoice.org. You can follow him on Twitter at @Jewish_voice. All right, we're going to dive below the fold really quick right now and lift up a story and try to make a connection that's designed to help you start and engage in conversations that on the surface don't appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles is actually going to help you transition a conversation from something, in this case, artificial intelligence and the interest of one person to actually implant a computer in your brain and actually then lead that into a conversation about God and godliness and his heart's desire for the world. So my jumping off point for this conversation is an article that appears on Vox.com, and it's entitled Yuval Harari on Why Humans Won't Dominate Earth in 300 Years. So his new book is called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. The only reason this guy should even be on your radar is he happens to be the favorite author of some really smart guys, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Barack Obama. They are actually loved his book, which was called Sapiens, and it's a favorite among that particular globalist crowd. And so I think that the globalist crowd is also going to be reading Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, And so we ought to be paying attention to what the guy who wrote it thinks. Because what the guy who wrote it thinks is that, well, you and I are going to be absolutely and utterly replaced by the rise of artificial intelligence and digital consciousness and digital intelligence, and that we are going to be essentially set aside. We're not only going to be replaced economically, we're going to become economically useless because everything will be done by robots and AI, robots equipped with AI. And so you and I are going to have to find something else to do. And that's what Yuval Harari then argues. He says, virtual reality, we're going to have to manage the problem not only of economic irrelevance by retreating into artificial wonderlands that give us meaning and a narrative, we're going to have to find something to do. Now, Harari argues that we have been doing that all along, and we've been calling it religion. Okay, so this is why this is an important thing for us to be paying attention to today. He says, AI taking over is not just an economic problem. The real problem is the problem of meaning. If you don't have a job anymore and the government provides you with a basic income, something like that, then the big problem is going to be finding meaning in life. What do you do all day? Well, here, the best answer so far we've got is drugs and computer games. People will relegate more and more of their moods with all kinds of biochemicals, and then they're going to engage more and more in three-dimensional virtual realities. Now, I got to tell you, that sounds like a life of absolute futility and meaninglessness, not meaning at all. And I think this guy needs to read the book of Ecclesiastes. We do not live in an absolutely futile reality, but he would say that we do. So he says, we have been finding meaning in virtual reality games for thousands of years. We've just been calling them religion. Listen to this paragraph, people. You can think about religion simply as virtual reality game. You invent rules that don't really exist, but you believe these rules, and for your entire life, you try to follow the rules. If you're a Christian, if you do this, you get points. If you sin, you lose points. By the time you finish the game, when you're dead, you've gained enough points, then you get to go up to the next level, also known as heaven. He says, we now have the technology to actually create heavens and hells, not only in our minds, but by using bits and using direct brain-computer interface. Really? You say, well, the good news is direct human brain-computer interface is science fiction. Well, that leads me to the next article that I want to lift up, and we won't have time to talk about this at length today, so I'm going to send you to a guest blog post at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We posted it on the 31st of January. It's by Michael Graham, and it's entitled Artificial Intelligence and Human Flourishing. Again, that's on reconnectwithcarmen.com, and it's by Michael Graham. You say to yourself, the integration of the human brain and an actual computer is not possible. That's science fiction. I don't need to worry about Yuval Harari's invitation for me to be lost in virtual reality through a game. And I would say, well, Elon Musk, whose name you should recognize, Elon Musk says that technology is only 4 or 5 years out. The Wall Street Journal posted yesterday that Elon Musk has launched a new company called Neuralink. He's going to connect brains directly to little computer chips that will be implanted therein. Now, what you should note is this is beginning as an answer to medical issues. This is beginning as a conversation about medicine, but that is not where it ends, and it rarely does. We in theology and ethics have got to catch up with the technology of the day. Otherwise, we're going to forget what it means to be human. All right, friends, that's all we got for you today. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Like us on Facebook. Let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.